How's that for real time? Well, it's great to be with you this evening and talk about the abnormalities of our day. Thank you, Doug, for that great customized warm-up. That was wonderful. Sometimes I fly into an area and I, you know, do my song and dance, and sometimes you wonder, you know, just what's going on in that community in the heads of people, you know, that's a localized, customized situation. So we're going to talk about broad issues here for a little bit, and then we're going to save some time for questions at the end. I always just have to sit and appreciate this venue. I mean, this is just, isn't this a cool venue? I always like to get away from here and just talk the acoustics. Can you hear me in the back? Isn't that amazing? That's so cool. All right. They don't make them like this anymore, you know. But you know, we modern Americans, we're brain damaged when it comes to talking about grass. We really are. I mean, our culture worships grain, doesn't it? I mean, we even, as the average American, we actually eat, you ready for this? Twice as much wheat today as we did 50 years ago. And you wonder why we got celiac disease and gluten intolerance. And you know, back in those days, it took time to process that wheat when you scythed it down. And it actually went through some moist and dry cycles that actually allowed the kernels to ferment just a little bit. And that secretes enzymes that are critical for proper digestion. Today, we cut it with a combine, put it right in a natural gas dryer, and it doesn't go through any of that fermentation process in the seed, and that's what's necessary to be able to digest the wheat. That's why we've got gluten intolerance and celiac disease. So, you know, things are different today. And one of the big differences is that we don't have an understanding or appreciation of pastoral or pasturage. You know, when I say grass, or when Doug said grass, you know, we think, most of us just think lawn, you know, what's out here that's heavily chemically fertilized and mowed with petroleum so you can spread a blanket and, you know, make eyes with your lover, you know. I mean, that's what it's for, right? Okay. So you know, or we think grass, we think golf course, right? You know, golf course, greens, whatever. But when I say grass, I'm talking about Laura Ingalls Wilder. And remember when they went out and Ma and Pa wouldn't let the children go out past the threshold of the soddy lest they become lost in the grass. I mean, you say that today and the average person says, good grief, if I did that around my house, the beautification committee would come and cite me for an ordinance violation for neglecting my lawn care. I'm talking about the kind of grass that was in the Shenandoah Valley where we live in 1700 when then colonial governor Spotswood sent his 10 cohorts. He was British after all. He dubbed them the Knights of the Golden Horseshoe and sent them across the Blue Ridge into the valley to scope it out because the settlers were starting to move over there, find out what it is. And they wrote back and said everywhere they rode in the valley, they took the grass and tied it in a knot above the horse's saddle. It was a magnificent silvopasture with widely spaced trees, chestnuts and oaks, maintained in open space by lightning fires. I mean, there wasn't any fire department. And by 3 million head herds of buffalo, elk and antelope chased by wolves that grazed through the valley and maintained this open character of silvopasture. I'm talking about the kind of grass you could go see today at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. They still maintain a 2-acre native prairie. You walk out there, I mean, it still makes chill bumps come up on me, even though I've described this a million times. You walk out in there, this grass, folks, is, I'm almost 6 feet. I'm 1 inch short of 6 feet. So imagine double me, 12 feet tall. 12 feet tall, the stems are 3/4 of an inch, as thick as hair on a dog's back. You walk out there and it just consumes you. Just and to imagine sitting on a buckboard seat in a Conestoga wagon, looking at hundreds of miles of waving solar energy biomass. That's what built this nation's wealth. And we are still mining it today. That the soil throughout history has always been built with perennials and herbivores. Always. The best soils in the world are always where the great herbivores and the perennials live. Because perennials store their energy in the roots, not up in the seeds, like annuals. Annuals put all their energy in the seeds and hope that, you know, there's enough energy there that somebody's going to take it and use it and then replant it next year. But the perennial has to go on its own root reserve bank account. And so the energy flow in an annual and a perennial are completely different. And historically normal, that's why all historically normal agriculture practices required several years of perennial pasturage between a very short period, maybe 1 or 2 years of tillage, because in a day before petroleum fertilizer, you couldn't replace the fertility in the soil with anything other than a long perennial pasture setting. Well, that was just fine, and it was necessary because all the farm's energy came from draft power. And draft animals are all herbivores. In 1910, the U.S. had 20 million draft animals. In the U.S. today, we actually have the same poundage of animals in domestic stock today that we did in 1910. Those draft animals have been replaced by other domestic animals, but the amount of animals is actually the same. But nature has always utilized that perennial portion, and of course, the greatest soils have been built where there was no tillage at all, like the, you know, Great American Plains. I'm talking about the kind of grass. We had an apprentice one time from Mexico. We went down to see his family. And his very, very elderly grandmother, now this is 20 years ago, she's passed away now, but they came from a moneyed family, and she went to a boarding school in 1910 up in British Columbia. And her family would drive her up there, stagecoach, and then gradually Model T finally, up to British Columbia to boarding school, and she'd stay there for a year. And she told me that In the early 1900s, as she drove up out of Mexico into Arizona, you could never see the landscape because the grass was so tall along the road you couldn't see out. Today, you drive those same roads. I was in the car with her. I mean, you couldn't feed one cow with 100 acres. It's just barren. So what happened to it? Well, it got overgrazed. But here's the thing. In nature's economy, the way it was, if you look at nature's pattern, nature's template, nature's economy, the herbivores don't stay on one place very long. They move. Wolves move them. In the Serengeti, the lions move them. In Botswana, the Cape Buffalo, the lions move them, okay? And you have this predator-prey relationship, and the herbivores move on and give that grass time to rest. Now, grass grows in a sigmoid curve. See my S? All right. I'm not directing the choir. I'm trying to make a picture here. S, okay? I call this diaper grass. This right here is teenage grass. This up here is nursing home grass, okay? And so if the grass can be kept between the diaper phase and the nursing home phase, that's when it produces the greatest amount of solar energy into decomposable biomass. And because of their grazing patterns with the predator-prey relationship and periodic fires, that created a movement pattern in these natural systems. Well, what happened was, here we came along as humans, and we just said, well, let's put up fences and let's just put them right in here and leave them. And then they grazed it and grazed it and grazed it down, and there was no recuperation cycle. There was no teenage growth spurt. There was no rest period. And gradually the grass degenerated to what we have today. And now, of course, everybody demonizes the cow, but it's not the cow. The cow is actually the most efficacious way to heal the planet. But don't blame the cow. Blame the management of the cow. Because actually the herbivore is a biomass accumulation restart button. The herbivore is what takes that nursing home grass and prunes it back, just like a viticulturist would prune a vineyard or an orchard, to stimulate verdant, luxuriant new growth and restart the biomass accumulation solar photosynthetic activity. That's the way it's supposed to be. Well, suddenly, here we were in our culture with cheap energy and mechanization, and for the first time in human history, we were able to break this inherent need for pasturage in between. And this created for the first time in civilization cheap grain. Now, why was grain always expensive? Well, because grain is an annual, and you've got to till
the soil, kill the grass. Well, if you have to walk behind an ox with a sharp stick all day,
okay, or a horse,
I got to say this as I go by,
or a mule, or a water buffalo, okay, you got to walk behind this stick all day. I mean, at the end of the day, you might be able to plow up something, you know, the size of this little front foyer here, okay? And then when you finally got all that tilled, then you could go out and you could take some grain and you could kind of, you know, fling it out there and it would sprout. Then you get to take a kind of crude hoe, you get to hoe it, keep the weeds out of it. And finally, you know, it grows up here. Now we get to take a crude scythe and we go out with a scythe and we scythe it down. We put it up in a shock to let it dry. About 3 weeks later, we come along with the shocks. We put them on a wagon, take them to the threshing floor. Now, the threshing floor, this is before concrete, so the threshing floor could be just a bunch of wood planks on the ground. It might be a hard clay area. It could be some crude lime, you know, that we put on to make a hard place. And you put those shocks on there, and you beat it out with a stick. You run an ox over it. You bring the, you know, all the kindergartners to play on it or whatever. But anyway, you mash through it. You thresh it, okay? And then you take it over here to a breezeway where the wind's blowing through. You take a fork and you fling it up in that wind. The wind blows through it, blows the chaff over here in this pile. At the end of the day, you got some grain. Look down there. Sure enough, you got some grain. So you scoop it up. Now we're going to try to keep this till next year. Where are we going to put it to keep it away from the mice and the rats in a day before sheet metal and wire mesh? We're going to put it in a clay pot. Put a lid on it. Grain was expensive. There's a reason why the in the Old Testament in the Bible, the book of Hosea talks about a harlot being sold for 9.5 ephahs of barley. It's about 2 bushels, you know. It's not because harlots were cheap. Grain has been expensive throughout the continuum of human history until extremely recent times. So what happened with the petroleum fertilizer and the mechanization of all these processes I've just theatrically demonstrated up here, grain for the first time in human history became cheap and easy to move. For the first time, we were able to move carbon long distances cheaply. See, in nature's economy, carbon doesn't move very far. Ever think about that? In nature's economy, carbon never moves very far. I mean, you know, the wind comes down and maybe blows the leaves over to the neighbor's yard. You know, it's about as far as it goes. And, a buffalo eats grass here and goes half a mile over there, lies down, poops. You know, that's okay. But, you know, bird, you know, eats some eats some seeds over here and flies up there in a tree and poops, you know. Nature doesn't move carbon around very much. In nature's economy, carbon is generated by solar energy, biomass, okay, and it generally stays kind of on in the general vicinity, you know, within a few miles, certainly. Suddenly, we were able to cut the moorings of that historical profit and loss sheet of our ecological umbilical. We were able to sever that P&L statement and say, oh, forget that. Now we can truck grain 1,000 miles. We can truck food 1,000 miles. And what that has led to today is for the first time in human history, we have an absolutely segregated farming and food system. Before very recent days, the food and farming system was always integrated because it was dependent on this solar carbon cycle, because in a day when all transportation required sitting on a buckboard behind an ox, you simply couldn't move that much material that far. So suddenly we were able to have concentrated animal feeding operations, because suddenly you could move the volume of carbon in and the volume of carbon out, grain in, manure out, they're both four forms of carbon. You could move it in and move it out. When it was all draft power transportation, you simply couldn't, it was too laborious to be able to accumulate that much stuff in one place and move it to one place and then move all the poop from that one place out into the far place. You simply couldn't do it. And so the laborious transportation inherently precluded the kind of concentration that we've been able to do. Okay? So once we started concentrating animals like this, then guess what happened? We started having a whole new genre of pathogens. Anybody younger than, or anybody older, say that, than 40 in here, I guarantee you when you were in grade school, you don't ever remember hearing the words E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria. Why? Well, they weren't around. What's happened? We've concentrated these animals in such tight areas that suddenly we've created a whole new genre of pathogenicity that is essentially, you know, all those little Latin squiggly words that we've learned to say. Really, that's nature's language screaming to us, enough! But we've still got our little conquistador uniform on, you know, and we're still looking at animals and plants as some inanimate pile of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated however cleverly we can manipulate it. And we've taken a very mechanistic view toward life. And as we've viewed it as life, as machines, we've lost all of the respect and honor for the biological community of beings that we are completely and utterly dependent upon. And all of nature's P&L statement that we were inherently tied to, our cleverness was held in check, if you will. Are you with me? Our ability to destroy nature was held in check by the sheer logistical problems of being able to move stuff. Yeah, we were still destroying things. I mean, humans haven't destroyed things just in the last few years. We've been destroying them for a long, 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 long time. We've also been doing some wonderful healing things for a long, 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 long time. You know, look at terracing. Look at the Inca and the Aztec civilizations and the Pueblos and you know, Brazil, the Amazonian rainforest. You know, now we know that the Amazon is not a wilderness area. It was a planted garden by civilizations that were 10 times as numerous as even everybody that lives there today. Nebraska and Kansas 600 years ago had more people living in them than they have there today. All right. These were huge civilizations and they were, but they were running on this essentially this ecological P&L statement that was held in check by simply the realities of life, which was, you know, laborious transportation, and they ran on real-time carbon. Now, what we've got today, of course, is a brand new permutation of these principles with aerobic compost. You know, people don't realize that scientific aerobic compost is only as old as chemical fertilization. It was developed by Sir Albert Howard in his research in Indore, India, and brought to the world in an agricultural testament in 1943. That's how recent scientific aerobic composting is, which of course was the biological answer to the fertilization problem, as opposed to the mechanical answer, which was chemical fertilization. The only reason that the compost pile didn't become as popular as the fertilizer bag was because all of the necessary protocols, infrastructure, and knowledge and distribution channels to leverage Howard's gift of compost was not in place. But everything to leverage chemical fertilization had been paid for by the war effort, because it was comprised of chemical N, P, and K, which is also what you make bombs and explosives out of. And so essentially, the Pentagon, the war effort, you know, because 1943, you know, there was a kind of a thing going on there in 1943. Okay. All right. So make sure everybody's awake. Okay. So in 1943, the war effort paid for all of the infrastructure, knowledge, distribution, and metabolism of being able to generate that NPK cheaply. And so that's why we've come up with this thing about, oh, how can we feed the world, you know, with a biological system? How can we, blah, 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 you know, got all this prejudice against it. Well, it took a decade, 15 years, for rural electrification, chippers, front-end loaders, PTO-powered manure spreaders, PTO tractors, polyethylene piping, you know, electric motors on farms. It took a while to get the necessary infrastructure in place to metabolize Howard's biological innovation. Okay? The fact is that if we had had a Manhattan Project for compost, not only would we have fed the world, we would have done it without infertile frogs, three-legged salamanders, and a dead zone the size of New Jersey in the Gulf of Mexico. Okay, that's the truth. And the whole, you got to realize that if we reverted to a biological notion that was held in check by draft power, by the necessity of pasturage, and by the necessity of real-time on-site carbon recycling and all that required, if we had been able to leverage that at the time of compost, we would have way outperformed the chemical approach. The only reason the chemical approach seems like it's, you know, the way to feed the world is because it just has so much inertia behind it. And it's taken our side a while to catch up. Well, now our side's caught up. We're spinning circles around the other side. I mean, now we've got, my goodness, we've got electromagnetically charged foliar seaweed extract emulsions that we beam on to the stomata playing calypso music. It makes the stomata open up real big and gulp in, you know, foliar biological things. I mean, we've just got all these cool things now that enable us to leverage that. And so I would suggest that in the future, when we talk about what's normal, I think in the future, we will of necessity begin abandoning the petroleum-based, chemically-based program and will return with our cool infrastructure. We will return to a real-time carbon-based system. Now, this drove also the whole animal approach. So we've talked about herbivores. So herbivores, you know, grain was way too expensive to feed to an herbivore. I mean, you couldn't even feed it to an omnivore. So what did you feed to omnivores? Pigs and chickens and things. The reason that all cultures, their dietary base was either herbivore-based, which includes dairy, includes, you know, yaks and camels, and all, okay, herbivore-based or seafood-based, was because those were the only two nutrient-dense dietary basics that could be produced without tillage. Okay? Because in a day when you had to follow the ox with a stick, tillage was too laborious to be the backbone of anything. All right. So in the future, we're going to revert to that. We're going to go back to that basis. I always tell people, you know, you want to really eat ecologically, forget eating chickens and pork. Eat grass-based herbivore, water buffalo, llama, oh, cow, you know, yak, whatever. Zebra, elk, venison, groundhog, gopher. All right, herbivore. Now, so what about the pigs and chickens? What were they? Their role historically was always as a fringe recycler. The pig was always on the outskirts. You know, George Washington, he was so meticulous in his record keeping at Mount Vernon. He always lamented the pigs because they could never get them all rounded up at the same time. They'd go out there once a fall and they'd round them up, and they'd always have a few stuck back in the brush that they couldn't find. And but they lived in the woods. They lived on chestnuts and acorns and just kind of, you know, around the edges. They ate in a day before refrigeration. They ate the whey from butter and cheese making. They ate the skim milk. I mean, until 20 years ago, nobody drank skim milk. Skim milk wasn't even worth drinking. You took the cream off and you poured the skim milk out for the pigs. And then the chickens were always right up next to the kitchen in the homestead. Why? Because they got all the kitchen scraps. We didn't have garbage disposals and landfills and a garbage truck that came and picked up the trash and took it away. So something had to recycle that. And so all that kitchen scraps, blemished fruit from the orchard, blemished vegetables from the garden, soured milk, clabber that went bad, all that sort of stuff. It went into the chickens. And so they were the ultimate recycler. And that's what fed the poultry and the pork, because grain was too expensive to feed them. We needed all the grain to bake bread and feed people. And people didn't eat very much of that either. Suddenly, now, here we are with this cheap grain thing. And so we have segregated all of these beautiful integrated carbon chains, local chains, these energy flows, all these historically normal energy flows. Now, you ready for this? 50% of all the human edible food in the world, 50% of it never gets eaten by humans. Never gets eaten by humans. 99% of it gets landfilled. You know, then we give Greenie awards, you know, for somebody that's clever enough to figure out, let's put a pipe in there and get the methane off of it so we can drive all the equipment to landfill. No. What we want to do is take all of that wonderful salvaged, blemished, spoiled, whatever, food and combine it to the animals that are right there. Okay? We want to combine it. We want to integrate it. If we want to be ecological, what we would do is not go to a kitchen waste composting program. We would get a couple of chickens and bring them into our apartment I mean, they don't take any more room than the aquarium or the parakeet cage, you know. And one average dog produces more poop than 11 chickens. So we feed them the kitchen scraps and they eat those and give us eggs. Now we don't have to have any factory eggs that eat grain. I mean, you could right here at the college, you could just put a chicken house up next to all the dining services places. If that happened, there would be no egg industry in the U.S. and the whole discussion of cage-free eggs wouldn't even be an issue. That's integration instead of segregation. And you know, and we could spice it up with high tech. I mean, we could divide the campus here. I mean, you're already irrigating, and all right. I mean, so you just divide the campus up into sectors using GPS satellites, right? Sectors 1 through 300, right? You know, little quarter acre sectors. And every morning you get up and on your iPhone or your smartphone, you got an app, right? App, and the students wake up, you know, and they look on their app. Oh, it says that the strawberries are ready to pick in quadrant 34. So all the students go over to quadrant 34 and pick strawberries, and you know, tomorrow to get up and the apples are ready in quadrant 68 and 69. All the students go over, you know, the students just graze from class to class. I mean, you don't even need any dining services. And you just put in an edible landscape. I mean, it doesn't take any more work to put in an apple tree than it does a Bartlett pear that just makes blossoms. What kind of a deal is that? I mean, if we're going to do all this landscaping, we might as well make it edible. Do you know that America has 35 million acres of lawn and 36 million acres housing and growing feed for recreational horses? That's 71 million acres. That's enough to feed the entire country without a single farm. Now, you see, when I say segregated, what I'm talking about? I mean, we've even segregated our lives to where we say, if you can afford a 1,500 square foot house, you can live over here. But if you can only live a 1,000 square foot house, you can live over here. I mean, we wouldn't want the 1,500ers to have to talk to the 1,000ers. I mean, that would never work. Now, a lady came up to me recently from Texas, you know, and I'd spoken to a seminar down there. She said she just got fined by our homeowners association because she had the unmitigated gall to plant a tomato plant in her flower bed, and they have a covenant against farming in their homeowners association, and she put a tomato, and that's farming. The fact is, we cannot have this profound, a segregated thinking and have a sustainable future. We can't. We have to integrate. We have to move this stuff close to us. We have to reconnect with this ecological umbilical. We can't just, you know. That's what concerns me. I write this book was because I'm just concerned about all these under 40s that just think that the way we live is normal, and we're going to be the first civilization so clever and techno-glitzy and sophisticated that we're going to just sail off into some Star Trek Nirvana cosmic future with, you know, pills for breakfast, and we're going to be able to cut that mundane ecological umbilical. I don't think we're going to. I think it's going to be a long time before we cut that ecological umbilical. And we'd better learn to live within its constraints with normal, what I call ecological P&L flows. P&L state. Wouldn't it be cool? You know, you see the paper every morning. It's got the Dow Jones report, you know, and it's got the stock market and how it goes up and down. Wouldn't it be cool if every locality had an ecological P&L statement, you know, right, a little box right next to it, you know. McDonald's came to town, you know, it drops down. Somebody put in an edible yard, you know, goes up. You know, wouldn't it be cool if you could just keep that, you know, balance statement? I mean, you know, we're the first civilization in history that has ever routinely eaten food that you can't pronounce. Nobody's ever done that before. I mean, food that you can't make in your kitchen. You ever try making high fructose corn syrup in your kitchen? One of the coolest things I saw recently, I was out at Fort Bragg, California, and there were two ladies there that were doing a farm-to-school thing. And so middle school. Kids would come out the first day. They'd tell the kids to bring food. The kids would bring, you know, white Wonder Bread and, you know, Cheerios and Snickers bars and M&Ms and Twizzlers and stuff. And they had a big, about a 6 or 7 foot long, 3 foot wide vermicomposting box. Earthworms. Worms, okay? And so they'd open the lid and they'd tell the kids, you know, bury all that stuff over here. And then the two farm gals would bring in, they brought in some homemade, home ground whole wheat bread. You know, they balled that up and put it in there. And they put in an apple, they put in a banana, they put in some ground beef, you know, and they put in a little bit of, you know, wheat and covered it all up, closed the box. 2 weeks later, the students come back. And of course, you know, they're all excited to see what's going on. So the students run up there, they open the door, they say, okay, now look in here, see what you find. They're looking over here, and they're pawing through the worms, you know, and all this stuff. The kids are all into that, you know. And, well, they can't find anything. It's just worms and castings. Beautiful, black, you know. Well, okay, we'll go over here. So they start pawing through. Oh, here comes the Wonder Bread. Here comes the Twizzlers. Here comes the M&Ms. Here comes the Cheerios. You know, here comes the, you know, Count Chocula, whatever. And the obvious question is, why would you want to eat something worms won't even eat? Isn't that a great, I mean, what a great thing. I just thought that was so clever. It was just, I've been sharing it with everybody because I think it just makes a wonderful, you know, we've got to get this, a visual aid. We've got to make this visceral for people to understand. You know, you can't just ignore it. Ultimately, our crisis is not a crisis of knowledge. It's not a crisis of resource. It's not a crisis of money. It's a crisis of participation. It's a crisis of participation in this amazing, wonderful world of community of beings that we're immersed in, that are in us. 3 trillion in us. 2 trillion per healthy handful of healthy soil. I mean, all these beings, you know, they're having elections and schools and our innards talk to the ones in the soil now, Stanford tells us. They've got a language, you know, and they talk to each other. And, you know, we put down something that's unpronounceable, you know, and it's like a foreign language. They all have to have a committee to decide, what are we going to do with this? Oh, we're going to put it over here in obesity, or we're going to put it over here in leukemia, or we're going to put it over here in type 2 diabetes. And they deal with these things. And so what we desperately need to understand is that we can't have this profound a divorce of historically normal participation with this wondrous community of beings in this food system and have a regenerative integrity future. We just can't. You know, I wish I could, you know, shake a magic wand and say, we don't have to do anything in here tonight. I mean, we came to the sermon, so we don't have to do anything. If all those people out there would start changing the way they live, everything would be fine. You know, we all kind of think that, don't we? I mean, really, down deep, don't we really think, you know, I'm doing well. I went to Whole Foods. I got my sanitized food down at, you know, wherever. Where we are right now today as a culture, big picture, where we are is the physical manifestation of billions of individual decisions that we've made as a culture. And where we'll be in 20 years will also be a physical manifestation of billions of little decisions that we make as a culture. I mean, decisions like, do I go on that Caribbean cruise the week that all of the farmers markets have extra tomatoes right before frost? Or do I schedule it later and stay home that week and talk to the farmers with tomatoes and say, listen, I know it's about to frost. It's late in the season. Do you have some slightly blemished tomatoes? I'll take 5 bushels of them. Our family's going to make juice and can sliced tomatoes and make salsa next week. Those kind of decisions are huge. Because I don't know if you know about, but tomatoes, they talk to each other right before frost. They kind of get together and they say, you know, frost is coming next week, so let's all ripen today. And the problem is, everybody's tired of tomatoes because it's late in the year and now we're ready for, you know, parsnips and root, you know, potatoes and squash and winter squash and all this stuff. And everybody's tired of tomatoes. Part of participation in this wondrous community of beings is eating seasonally and appreciating the abundance that nature gives at seasonal times. And then participating enough to get in our kitchens and prepare, preserve, and package the seasonal abundance for the off-season eating. This is called preparing or recreating your larder. You know, 100 years ago, if I came into Colorado Springs and went down Main Street and said, let's see where the food is. You know where the food would have been? It would have all been in everybody's larder. Today, you go down the street in Colorado Springs, where's the food? Well, the food's all 500 miles away in a Costco warehouse. We don't even use the word larder anymore. Well, it's too expensive to eat locally. That's what people say. It's too expensive. It's not too expensive if you use your own domestic culinary arts. What we've got is a culture that for some crazy reason derives far more pleasure out of being the top points getter on Angry Birds than we do out of using our domestic culinary techno glitzy gadgets and creating a domestic larder. I mean, we're far more interested in the latest belly button piercing in Hollywood celebrity culture than we are what's going to become flesh of our flesh and bone of our bones at 6 o'clock. We are. I mean, you know, do you know that the average American male right now, statistically, the average American male between 25 and 35 spends 20 hours a week playing video games? Not females. They're not that stupid. Males, 25 to 35. And we're talking about the most virulent, masculine bloom of manhood, 25 to 35. 20 hours a week. I mean, really? Are we that bored? I mean, to be able to go out on a patio garden in a pot, put 2 seeds in there and watch them come up into a tomato that makes a blossom, the bees come, the dew goes, and then little green tomatoes come, and then they turn red, and we bite into that, and then the juice just flies, and it runs down our hands. It's not this genetically selected cardboard from, you know, Peru, you know, that's been selected. I mean, all the tomato breeding in our culture is to select a tomato that can sit there and take about 1,500 miles of jostling, you know, between the field and the fork. And a tomato that's selected for that doesn't taste very good. You might as well gnaw on that pew there in front of you. And I think it's important. That's why I like gardening. For children, it's so important to learn that I don't have the world at my Game Boy fingertips. You know, when you're running your Game Boy and your car wrecks, well, you wait 10 seconds and game gives you a new car. And you know, take off again. That's not the way life is. In real life, if you wrap your car around a tree, you don't just walk away and life gives you another car. Or, you know, you get in a battle and, you know, your icon gets, you know, dead, decapitated, and you wait 10 seconds and you get a new icon. That's not the way life is. Real life is if I don't take care of this tomato plant and it dies, I don't wait 10 seconds and life gives me a new tomato plant, it's dead. And to learn our utter utter dependency. We're raising a generation, I think, that just feels completely, I'm above this. I'm above air, soil, and water. I'm above food. I'm above farming. I'm above soil. I'm above actinomycetes and gibberellins. You know, we don't even think about them in the shower. And yet we are completely and utterly dependent on this magnificent, invisible life in this womb, in this dance. And it is begging all of this life, the tomatoes and the earthworms, they are begging us to dance with them in this wonderful, marvelous, elegant, relational, complex, symbiotic, synergistic dance. And the question is, when are we going to participate? When are we going to come to that dance? And so my challenge to all of us is that we realize that there is no they and them and those people. There's really only us. And as we begin to embrace this wonderful, majestic community of beings, we begin little by little, decision by decision, changing our world. I mean, these are decisions that are as simple as you know, do I go and pay, you know, $3 for a pasture chicken, or do I spend $100 on jeans with holes already in the knees? These are the decisions we make. They are. And it's not up to somebody else. It's ultimately up to us. Finally, we're the first culture that has erected a swarm of bureaucracy. I call them the food police, that has defined what we can and cannot eat. You know, it's amazing to me to go friends just went to Mount Vernon and brought back Martha Washington's cookbook. And you open this thing up, and I mean, there's quince, gooseberry, juneberry, persimmon, all sorts of dairy permutations, sauerkraut, pickles. I mean, pickle. And you look through this thing, and suddenly the thought that strikes me is, my goodness, we don't have any variety today. We go in the supermarket and we think, oh, wow, look at all this. It's basically reconfigurations of corn and soybeans. All these products, and they're all, they come out of the same tube. I mean, they just slap a different label on them. They all come out of the same, you know, Archer's Daniels, Midland, irradiated, amalgamated, reconstituted, extruded fecal soup machine. You know, they just slap different labels on them. And we live in a culture that for the first time has decided that all this heritage food and traditional stuff and living food is hazardous. How can something give me life that's already dead before it comes to me? It needs to be living. It's not sterile. It's not irradiated, sanitized, reconstituted, you know, torn apart, wheat germ thrown away. We put in vitamin A and say, now it's enriched. It's not enriched. All of our food science is about shelf life and stabilizers and how to create, you know, sterilization. You know, so that now we've come to a culture in which it's perfectly safe to feed your kids Mountain Dew, Twinkies, and Cocoa Puffs. But that raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, Aunt Matilda's pickles, and free-range chicken will kill you. And so, what we need to do is participate in this food system as eaters to patronize the local farmers and the local producers and the small system that's being systematically demonized by the food police, and take responsibility for our own food system. Ultimately, it's about my health, my community of beings, and when the government gets between my lips and my throat, I call that an invasion of privacy. I don't understand why this is why this is not a freedom worth fighting for. I mean, what good is it to have the freedom to assemble, to worship, to speak, and to have guns if we don't have the freedom to decide what to eat, to feed our 3 trillion member community, to give us the energy to go shoot, pray, and preach? I mean, the only reason our founding fathers did not guarantee us freedom of food choice in this country was because they couldn't have envisioned when our government would send SWAT teams out to shoot our heritage pigs because they don't look quite right, or to confiscate what's in our freezers and get between consenting adults in their food decisions. They couldn't have imagined the day. And so that's going to be something that, as we begin participating and taking market share away from, you know, the Monsantos and the Tysons and the Smithfields of the world, they will not go gently into the night. And they will use their political power, their lobby effort, and their strength to use the government enforcement agencies to try to maintain market share. And so that is why our participation is so important, because ultimately this is not an issue that's going to be solved at the governmental level. It's going to be solved at the grassroots as individuals in their own homes look at their own families and their own internal community and say, you know what? I'm in charge here. And we begin exercising our own responsibility. That's the most basic, sacred, historic responsibility as caretakers, as those who must are mandated by our Creator to massage the creation and make this ecological womb more productive, more regenerative, and ultimately stimulate that ecological P&L statement. That's our responsibility. That's why we have a big brain. That's why we have an opposing thumb. That's why we are what we are. That's what we bring to it. And so ultimately, we are participants in this community of beings, in this womb, to reattach, reconnect, and rebuild this healthy, healing, ecological umbilical. And as we do that, we will create a sustainable, regenerative, healing future in which we will be able to have fewer hospitals instead of more, in which people will have fewer health issues instead of more, in which we will have more soil instead of less soil, and we will have a shrinking dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico instead of an expanding dead zone, and we will not be as dependent on petroleum, and we will actually have rejoicing in our community of beings inside of us, and they will thank us. And our grandchildren will thank us as we preserve the inherent normal relationships and cycles that have stood civilizations and glued them together and held them up over time. Are we up to the task? Great. Well, let's go do it. Thank you so much for letting me visit with you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. You're very kind. I have 8:25. Do we want to do questions for how long? You're in charge. I'm not in charge. 10 minutes? 10 minutes. We'll do 10 minutes of questions. If you have to go, if you got a babysitter that's ready to on her left ear or whatever, why, you know, go. But we'll go 10 minutes and we will call it a night. So questions are on the floor. Anything? Yes. Yeah, the question is, any experience with sovereignty ordinances and those kinds of things? Actually, those are being written. Sedgwick, Maine was the first one. that actually wrote, and then two more townships in Maine wrote one, and then I understand that Marin County, California, what would you expect, is working on one. But these are called food sovereignty ordinances, in which a locality comes together and says within the confines of our township or our, you know, whatever our political subdivision is, we're going to be food sovereign in as much as anyone can produce, process, and sell to an end user. In other words, direct sale, not to Walmart or whatever, but direct sale between individuals within our jurisdiction without any licensing bureaucracy or food police in between that consenting relationship. Of course, there have been three of them written, and they're already being sued by the state. They're being sued by the federal. And so it's an interesting thing. We're back to states' rights, local rights, that sort of thing. The conundrum is, the political conundrum is, that people like me who suggest that there should be a constitutional amendment called a Food Emancipation Proclamation. That would essentially allow direct food commerce between producer and eater. Okay. Anyway, that I think that would be a great thing. The problem is that the other side, the Monsantos of the world, and the health department, the government officials of the world, who live in this paranoia fear thing, say that if we did that, we wouldn't be able to grow. We wouldn't be able to build enough hospitals to handle all the sick people that were being hurt by tainted food from dirty farmers. And they mean that sincerely. They're not making this up. I mean, the world of intrigue and fear that they're living in is palpable. In fact, I think it's important to note that the Romans had a saying that you could tell the strength and health and stability of a civilization by the number of laws that it has. When a civilization is very strong and virile and stable, it doesn't worry about the lunatic fringe. Well, if they want to smoke dope, if they want to wear, no wear helmets with motorcycles, if they want to, whatever, that's cool. We're okay with the lunatic fringe. But as a civilization becomes very anemic and paranoid and fearful and weak, that's when it starts trying to circle the wagons with more laws and laws and laws and laws. And of course, that's exactly where we're headed. So the problem is that we need to be able to allow localities to try some prototyping, some embryonic prototyping on a policy level so that we could test if we allow some food freedom, would everybody get sick or would everybody get well? But we don't have the mechanism to test it. And that's why this is so important, to be able to have some food sovereignty options here. It's a great question. Yes. Yes, sir. Flyer in the foyer about a Heritage Seed deal. Seed Library. Okay, great. Question.
You hear people talk about the need for a second green revolution. I'm wondering if you would care to comment on that in terms of a lot of that's outside of America. A lot of it seems to be dependent on the idea of what's the new paradigm to increase this food production.
Yeah, well, Bill Gates, I mean, they're funding all sorts of, chemical. I mean, all the U.S. aid around the world is all, GMO-based. Green revolution. The revolution we need to have is to shut down the U.S. help around the world that is displacing the indigenous food system that has operated very, very well for a long, long time. One of the most fascinating things I did was when I was at Terra Madre in Italy several years ago, with the slow food movement, I was speaking, but when I wasn't speaking, I went to every single African delegation I could go to. And every single one of them started out saying, we have all the resource, we have all the water, we have everything we need to feed ourselves. West, quit dumping your junk on our people and displacing our food systems. Every single one of them. And so that's the revolution we need, is to quit offering our help to the world. And let the world function very, very well. We've got plenty to do here at home. Thank you very much. Yes. absolutely. You sound like you've been studying some permaculture. Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I'm a total fan of permaculture. You know, the fact is that food systems normally, the whole thrust was the basis of it. Basically, annuals were kind of gingerbread, but the guts of the food system was always perennial. Vines, orchard, grass, herbivore. I mean, it was always perennially based. And because tillage was so laborious. So, you know, if you could get some wheat, great. You know, we'll grow some and we'll eat it. But we're not going to count on that. And that was always normal until extremely recent days. So, yeah, there's work at Badger Set Farm in Wisconsin where they're actually going toe-to-toe with filberts versus soybeans. And they're actually far more productive per acre than soybeans. And this is a perennial, doesn't need fertilization, makes a leaf drop, you know, far more productive. But, you know, it doesn't get a government subsidy, and it's not our psyche. I mean, you got to realize, when you start talking about going to just the idea of going to a perennially based system instead of an annual based system. Remember, all the six crops that the U.S. subsidizes are all annuals. Just saying perennial rather than annual, just that, would completely, I mean, forget direct marketing, forget localization, forget any of these things, other things, just that would completely invert the power, position, profit, and prestige of the entire U.S. food system. One more question and we're going to call it a night. Yes. Oh my, I mean, farm, you know, why is one farm profitable, one not, you know, I don't know anything about the situation, and certainly I'm sure your father is the greatest guy in the world, but the truth is there are lots of variables in this equation, from staff to picking the right product to the right mix of products to the right to the right value adding amount, to the right market presentation, to the right people relationships. You know, are all the marketers smiling, or are they like a lot of farmers that would rather be, you know, out, have a better relationship with their tractor than their customers? I'm not trying to, believe me, I'm not picking, I'm not disparaging, I'm just saying that why does one struggle more than another? Well, you know what? I've struggled too. I mean, I could keep you up all day about our struggles. The fact is that it is a struggle. And I mean, if it were easy, well, that would take all the fun out of it. So my dad used to say, if at first you don't suck a seed, just suck and suck and suck until you do suck a seed. And you just... So I mean, I can't speak to the specific situation, but trust me, all of us that do this, Doug, has yours been a cakewalk? No, it hasn't been a cakewalk. Ours hasn't been a cakewalk. Yours is not a cakewalk. It's not easy, you know, and especially when you're going against the grain like we are. And so I just encourage you, stay with it, carry on, because ultimately, you know, it is that perseverance and that faithfulness with what we know to do that is moral and right, that leaves legacies worth living for and dying for. One final thing, and I'm going to close. Okay, thank you for the question. One final thing, and that is, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly first. You know, we've all heard this statement. You know, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. You know, you got the old, you know, grandma's behind you, you know, and she's telling you it's worth doing, it's worth doing. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. Well, Grandma was wrong. The truth is, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly first. When I talk about getting in the kitchen, when I talk about preserving, I mean, I know I'm talking to people that, oh, if I can, what if the canner blows up, you know, and blows the house up? And what if, you know, what if the cake falls? What if, you know, what if the meat sets off the smoke alarm? What if, you know, all these things. And the fact is that going down new road, you know, what if the tomato doesn't grow? What if, you know, what if I've got too much, you know, molybdenum in the soil, you know? And I mean, there's a million demons out there, a million things. The fact is, once we start participating on any level, it becomes easier. And you have to do it poorly first. Think about it. Last time you went to Thanksgiving dinner with all the family, and little Janie, the newest little addition to the family, you know, she's crawling around on the floor, she's 7, 8 months old, you know, and everybody's talking, adults and stuff, and suddenly here Janie comes up here to the chair leg, you know, and she gets a hold of it, she climbs up on the chair, she toddles there a little bit, you know, and suddenly, you know, somebody sees her, oh, look, you know, Janie's starting to stand, you know, and of course then Janie realizes she's now the center of attention, so she smiles real big, you know, of course loses her focus, loses her grip, plop, she falls down on her diaper. Now what does everybody do? Everybody gets up, right, and comes running over to Janie and says, well, Janie, if you can't walk any better than that, just quit. Is that what they say? No. They say, oh, look, she's starting to walk. She's getting around. Everybody's all excited about Janie, right? Well, why is it we turn adult and suddenly we're scared to death to try something new? You know, the fact is, we don't talk well first. We don't walk well first. We don't even poop well first. We got to learn all of these things. And so the fact is, you won't grow your best garden first. You won't do your best cooking first. You won't do your best kimchi first. You won't make your best butter first. You know, but once we decide to participate in this marvelous thing, in this visceral relationship, in this connection, and just allow ourselves to fall into this wonderful womb of the Creator's abundance, it does get easier, it gets better, and we become skillful at it. And suddenly all those demons and all those things that used to we just think we can't overcome it. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough ability. I didn't grow up this way. You know, mom didn't teach me this, blah, blah, blah. Suddenly it just dissipates because it does get easier and skill comes with practice. Now may all of your carrots grow long and straight. May your radishes be large and not pithy. May your tomatoes be immune from blossom and rot. May all of your culinary experience be edible. May the rain fall gently on your fields, the wind be always at your back, your children rise up and call you blessed, and may we all make the world a better place than we found. Thank you so much for letting me visit with you. Thank you very much.